Thanks for tuning in for Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU and 88.5 WMUB. I'm Mark Purcell, and in the studio with me is one of the co-authors of a book called The Heart of Everything That Is, The Untold Story of Red Cloud, an American Legend. Tom Clavin wrote the book with Bob Drury, and Tom's in the studio with me this afternoon to talk about Red Cloud. And I have to say, Tom, you say in the afterword that Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse are kind of like Smith and Wesson of the tales of the old Wild West. Mm. But Red Cloud's frequently overlooked. Why do you think Red Cloud, despite his notoriety, as we'll learn, was overlooked for so long?
I think there's a couple of reasons to that. I mean, after working on this book, I'm firmly of the belief that Red Cloud was the most significant American Indian leader of the 1800s, you know, hands down. And people can make arguments for Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse and Cochise and some of the others and Quanah Parker and that wonderful book of a couple of years ago, The Empire of the Summer Moon. But Red Cloud reached the peak of his power really with the culmination of what became known as Red Cloud's War. When that ended in 1868, he basically went into retirement. He said, I've done everything I could to try and stop the white man from taking our sacred land. He went into retirement. He did not, like Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, die a martyr's death. He also, being that 1868 was like the end of his years of power, he was not a subject of all the reporters that were flooding into the West after the Civil War to write about the towns being formed in Dodge City and the action on the plains between the army and the Indians. He was really on the edge of that. So by the time that you had an event like Little Bighorn and Custer and Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse was part of that too, that was a very well-covered event. I mean, there weren't any reporters on the scene, but the word got around fast back east, and there was a sensation over that. And Sitting Bull suddenly became the poster boy for the aggressive, American Indian that had faced their ultimate defeat. So Red Cloud, from a popular culture standpoint, has been overlooked. A big reason for that, he just didn't get the press.
It's an amazing story, especially when you see the reach of Red Cloud's influence. Mm-hmm. And you're stretching from North Dakota. Mm-hmm. Just amazing that the area, what I think you describe it in the book, is larger than Texas.
Yeah, it really was about one-fifth of the lower 48 was the territory that Red Cloud and his Lakota Sioux and their allied bands of Indians, the Arapaho and the Cheyenne, controlled. And that's why it was so shocking when people like William Tecumseh Sherman, who was put in charge of the Western Division, was being briefed by his commanders in the field. And they said, well, from this point on, it's Red Cloud's territory. And he was like, what are you talking about? Who is Red Cloud? And you're telling me that he controls this much land? And it was just astonishing to these army officers who were freed of their Civil War service, who were coming west, to discover that there was such an imposing Indian leader there.
And not realizing what a warrior mentality the Indians had. Mm-hmm. These were nomadic persons, mm-hmm. In tribes, and you do a fantastic job in the book of describing the society and the Indians' approach to life, that they were very much warriors, that what the white people considered atrocities were just the way life was for the Indians.
That was it. I've sort of described it as it was kind of like gang warfare west of the Missouri, with these different Indian tribes being the gangs, and they were always fighting for territory. Now, it wasn't just for ego purposes. They wanted to say, well, I control 100,000 acres. It was for survival. They wanted to control the best hunting grounds because being able to the buffalo and bison and other animals, that was how they survived. They stole horses from each other, because horses was a symbol of how powerful you were as a tribe. And that was where Red Cloud and his youth became a leader. A big reason why is he could steal most horses from the other tribes. And that gave him a lot of juice as far as the power in the tribe was concerned. So they fought among themselves a lot. There were the atrocities where their belief system included that you entered heaven, whatever you want to call it, the happy hunting ground, the way that you died. And the worst thing you could do to an enemy is not only kill them, but say dismember them, or poke their eyes out, or do other, even more disgusting things to their person, because that's the way they would then enter the afterlife. And so you wanted to punish them in this life, anyone to take care of them in the afterlife, too. When the army contingents and the first settlers and the migrants and the explorers came to that part of the country, the plains especially, they were appalled by what they saw the Indians doing to each other, and then eventually they would be doing it to the white people. And we have scenes in the book where you have soldiers who are making suicide pacts with each other. Listen, you know, if they're under attack, for example, and the Indians are about to break through, we put each one of us puts a gun to the other guy's temple. We got to kill ourselves. There's no way we can fall into the hands of the Indians. It should be noted that it didn't take very long for the members of the army and other people from the Europeans from the West to pick up on these atrocities and return them on the Indians. So it became kind of a free-for-all out there.
It really got my ire up about how badly the Indians were treated. Mm-hmm. You know, they talked about dealing with the government and the double standards that the government mm-hmm. had. When they create treaties and then the government would break the treaties
right.
and say, we're not doing this. And
yeah.
And this book really, I think, displays that duplicity.
Yeah, yeah. The treaties were completely a white man's invention. First of all, the Indian belief system was that nobody owned the land. So they found it laughable that negotiators would approach them and say, we want to do this treaty with you, and you will give us, you know, half of Colorado or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah, well, go ahead. We don't. Sure. You know, whatever you want. Just give us some food and give us some trinkets and we'll sign whatever you want. The treaties were fabrications. I do like to believe that there were some people who were sincere that a treaty was to protect both sides and the best interests of both sides. But in every case, the treaty ended up being broken, especially if gold was found on land that was supposedly, you know, to be for the Indians forever. Gold, you know, everything was off. You know, if gold was found, then that is the next piece of property we're going to take from the Indians.
The book begins with the Horse Creek Treaty of mm-hmm. 1851. I mean, mm-hmm. it does go back and look at Indians prior
right,
to that time, but
right.
this big gathering where mm-hmm. they were going to make this treaty, and that was kind of the first formal treaty, if I interpret things correctly.
It was certainly the most comprehensive one, and they called together a whole array of tribes, and there were 10,000 Indians who attended this peace conference at Fort Laramie in 1851, and there had never been anything like that before. I mean, there had never been any reason why that many Indians and from different warring tribes would for a week or so come together and be peaceful and celebrate and interact with each other. And the idea was that this treaty of 1851, the Horse Creek Treaty, was supposed to forever protect the interests of the Indians and at the same time give the white people some inroads, some trails that they could safely go on. And it was a very idealistic thing to do. I mean, how different our history would be if everybody involved had lived up to that treaty.
Yes.
But within just a few years, it was as if it had never happened.
Horses play a big role in the life of Indians. As I said, they began, the tribes were very nomadic,
mm-hmm.
maybe because you reach back in the book to the very early times
mm-hmm.
of Indian tribes. And it's very enlightening to see how much, number one, the tribes differed in their approaches to
mm-hmm.
life,
right.
how much they were similar as well, and then how things like horses and repeating revolvers changed life for the Indians.
It did. You know, Hollywood has led us to believe that the Indians were always excellent horsemen and always had many, many horses available to them. And horses, for the Sioux, for example, were kind of late to their party. But horses transformed that tribe and helped them become more powerful, as did access to weapons. You know, one of the things we point out in the book is that when the first Europeans are encountering the Plains tribes in the early 1800s, after Lewis and Clark, and in the 1820s and 30s, where you had Jim Bridger and Kit Carson and other mountain men who were exploring that whole territory, they were really confronting almost a Stone Age culture. A very rudimentary Stone Age culture, which did not have sophisticated weapons, which had only spears and arrows, which was still learning how to make use of horses, which would steal horses as the way they would, you know, give each tribe some stature and the better ability to hunt food. So it was an enormous culture shock that over a period of really just a couple of decades, the Indian tribes were transformed, especially by weapons.
I was going to say, I think there's a description from one explorer talking about his amazement in seeing the Indians kill a buffalo and with a piece of flint no bigger than their thumb, strip the hide off and cut the meat up.
Right, right. Well, what they used to do too is they would find a herd of buffalo and they would stampede them and direct them towards a cliff. And that's how they would kill buffaloes, you know, in some kind of plentiful form that could feed the tribe through the whole winter, is the buffalo would fall to their death off this cliff. And then, like you say, they would use these rudimentary Stone Age almost pieces of flint and sharpened rock to strip the hides off. So you can imagine what it was like for a society like that to suddenly be handed rifles and six guns and things like that. It was, you know, there's many instances in battles, and certainly some of the ones that we portray in the book, in which there were as many Indians, if not more, they killed each other in a battle than were killed by the army because they were not marksmen. They would just fire indiscriminately, and, you know, sometimes they would hit a soldier, sometimes they would hit another member of the tribe. So it was a remarkable, you could say advance, in the sense that it was advanced technology, but it probably put them in a position of justifying increasing attacks on them. Well, look, they've got guns now. We gave them the guns. Look, they've got guns now.
Right.
You know, we better make sure that they don't try and hurt us. Let's hurt them first.
Another thing you point out with Red Cloud and the only Indian to have a war named for
right.
him was the fact that he was a military strategist.
Yes.
Unlike the other Indian tribes, and at times he was frustrated with some of the braves and warriors he was working with because they were they would be just running around pell-mell. But he was very much a strategist and learned.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that's as much as anything in the book that we portray. It shows how remarkable Red Cloud was because no Indian leader had before then been able to, first of all, think in a tactical way. Okay, here's how we can't defeat the army by confronting them head on, like the North and South did in the Civil War. He devised a whole guerrilla war tactics, which the army did not encounter again until Vietnam, when the Viet Cong did it to them. You know, we had won the Revolutionary War with guerrilla tactics and then forgot them. Because then we were the army after that. Red Cloud realized a war of attrition, you know, attack and melt away was the way to go. He also was the first one that he would get other tribes to go to war under his flag, so to speak. That had not been done before. You know, some people will say, well, didn't Sitting Bull do that? He had other tribes with him when he attacked Custer. That was 10 years after Red Cloud's war. You know, and he was a protege of Red Cloud. Red Cloud taught Crazy Horse, all these other Indian leaders. They first learned it from Red Cloud, and he devised it himself because there was no precedent in Indian society for these kind of strategies.
And Red Cloud really helped you out with the book, The Heart of Everything That Is, by having shared his story in an autobiography.
Yeah, I mean, we know so little about Indian societies, especially of the Plains Indians, before the Civil War. There was very few people were doing any kind of recording of it. There were some explorers. There were some missionaries who would write about their experiences as they went among the native peoples. But nothing really from an Indian point of view because they did not read or write. There was no tribal historian, you know, who was jotting down what the experiences were. There were some illustrations. But what Red Cloud did when he was an older man and living on the Pine Ridge Reservation is an old friend of his would sit with him at the post office, and this friend would ask him questions about some of the old days, and Red Cloud would tell some stories. And what he didn't know, although we suspect he knew something was up, is that after Red Cloud left to go home, this friend of his would run to the postmaster, who would be writing everything down. Eventually, there was something called Red Cloud's autobiography. It disappeared twice. After this guy was, the postmaster was finished writing it, he sent it to somebody at the Nebraska Historical Society, which was just being formed, hoping that it would help get it published. It disappeared. It reappeared in the 1930s, where it was typed. It was typed up, disappeared again until the 1990s, when it was discovered, some dusty archive there. And so when we were able to obtain a copy of Red Cloud's autobiography, which is not in the first person, it's not a true autobiography, but he talks so much about his boyhood, his childhood, the fights, the battles with the other, with the Pawnee and the Crow and the other tribes in the 1830s, 1840s, a kind of a amazing, exciting, dramatic fight and life for survival that we otherwise had only glimpses of before.
What did you find most fascinating as you were writing The Heart of Everything That Is, the untold story of Red Cloud?
I felt the enormous privilege of that we were writing it for the first time. Now, I'm not saying that nobody's ever written about Red Cloud. You can find some very good academic work that's been done. But what we wanted to do was write this book as a rip-roaring yarn, so to speak, you know, because there's so much drama in it in
Red
Cloud's
is,
life,
yes.
and then with his encounter with the white man and the dictate down from General Sherman that when he sends the army west, your orders are to capture or kill Red Cloud, you know, it becomes in that sense like a John Ford movie. But as we're doing this, we're also realizing, you know, we're talking about an amazing man of great character and charisma that for a general audience has never been presented before. So I think there's a constant feeling of surprise, like, why hasn't somebody done this book, this kind of book before? Well, somebody hasn't, thank goodness. We're doing it.
wonderful job, and it is a rip-roaring yarn there for sure.
Thank you.
And appreciate you bringing Red Cloud to light.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It's been a great journey for Bob and I to work on this, and we think people who read it they'll see it as a journey because it really covers a lot of ground and amazing characters.
Amazing characters that include a couple with Ohio connections mm-hmm. as well that we didn't touch on. We'll let readers discover that as mm-hmm. it goes along. Mm-hmm. Tom Clavin, who with Bob Drury wrote the book The Heart of Everything That Is, The Untold Story of Red Cloud, an American Legend, available where books are sold. You can find out more about Tom and Bob and their work on The Heart of Everything That Is on our website, wvxu.org.